Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. I know it's only been a couple of days since we last spoke. We did the post-Newcastle podcast on Wednesday with Art DeRoche, and I wasn't sure if we were going to have a podcast today because I didn't know if there would be enough really to talk about. But I think there are a couple of bits and pieces going on, a couple of things that we could delve into today. So it might not be the longest Arsecast of all time, but it's still an Arsecast. And what more could you want? Apart from, of course, to have a good guest to have the chat with. And, well, we've got a good guest. It's my pleasure to welcome back Clive Palmer. Hello, Clive.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Yes, I'm good. I'm absorbing the Newcastle game and seeing where it's taken us, right? It's an interesting game, isn't it?
It is an interesting game. And you know what I thought about afterwards? Not that I always think of you, but I did think of something that you've spoken about more than once in your podcasting life. And you talk about how the opposition, the way that they play, tells you a lot about yourself.
Yeah.
Right? As a team. And I watched Mikel Arteta's post-game interview on Sky, and he talked about, you know, he was asked about the approach that Newcastle came, they defended in a low block and 11 men behind the ball and all that kind of stuff. And he was much more keen to give credit to his players for the way the game went, because he said that's not how Newcastle play. And I spoke about it on the Arsecast on Wednesday and with Art, and a few people sort of pointed out to me that Eddie Howe had said something like this in his post-game interview on Sky, which I watched, but this bit passed me by. So I'm just going to play this little bit from Eddie Howe here. You'll probably be able to hear it now.
We wanted to attack the game. We wanted to be ourselves. The reality of that, I don't think we quite were, but I think that's credit to Arsenal with how they played. I think they forced us to sit a little bit deeper than we would normally want to. But sometimes you have to do that. In a game, you have to slightly tweak how you play to stay in the match. I felt we had to, we did, and the players deserve all the credit for coming through that test.
So, like, what do you make of that? Because my first thought after the game was like, oh, Newcastle came, they just wanted to sit, they wanted to spoil. But what Arteta said, what Eddie Howe said, sort of puts the performance in a slightly different context, or a different light anyway.
Yeah, so basically I think before the game, Andrew, I must have misread this game, because I was thinking, post St James's Park in the spring, I'm thinking it's going to be a backwards forwards NBA game, you know, basketball game. Remember when they pushed it down the line and Callum Wilson ran in behind? I'm thinking they brought him back for this game. I'm thinking they're going to get us to run backwards, and you know, with my worry head on, I'm thinking Rashford got us to run backwards. Remember at Manchester United, I'm thinking it's going to be a challenge for Saliba. Is he rusty? Blah, blah, blah. All this sort of stuff's going through my head, right? So the game kicks off. They go long. I'm thinking, there you go, Clive. You are right again. Just give myself a pat on the back. You know what I mean? Exactly as I imagined. And then we run at them. And then we run around them. Then we create three chances in like 7 minutes or so. And it's like, oh, okay. Then the game adjusted, and it was maybe a credit to us that we forced them to change their plan, because I think they did want to play in our half and go long and then fill in behind, win the second balls and play, create set pieces and big man opportunities, because they're a big team, right? So, but we changed it and we forced them to protect their house, you know, and then in the end we continually won that battle. And in the end, by the end of the game, they decided we better hold on to this. And it became attack versus defense. So I do think it was such an interesting night for the perception of both clubs and where they are. and how teams are going to react to both clubs going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you tweet something about what does this night tell us about brand Newcastle? What do you think it told us about Newcastle? Did it sort of suggest that, okay, they're riding high, they're obviously very well organized, they've got good structure, they're difficult to break down, they're a big team, they're powerful, they get men in, they can react very well in game, as we saw, you know, when Saka had a bit of freedom in the early minutes to run at Dan Byrne, he never really got that again. You know, sometimes there were two, sometimes there were three players. It was either Joe Willock dropping in, Joe Linton dropping in. As soon as Saka had it, you know, they tweaked things from a tactical point of view. So you can see, you know, why they haven't conceded many goals this season. But, I mean, does it suggest perhaps that they are... Remember when under Unai Emery, everyone was saying this unbeaten run we're on, it doesn't really stack up when you look at the underlying stats. Are they just sort of a little bit ahead of where they should be, if that makes sense? Because you could kind of make the same argument about us when we think about where we were going to be at the start of this season. If we were where Newcastle were, for example, and there were, you know, City ahead of us and Liverpool ahead of us, we'd probably be thinking, that's about right.
Yeah.
So what do you think it says about Newcastle?
I think, for me, if you're a coach, you need to put your flag in the ground. And maybe I misread Eddie's flag, right? Because I just expected something else. I expected a bit more football. On the highlights, you know, we watch our own team religiously, don't we? But on the other teams, we get snippets and bits and pieces. And if there's a big game, we get to see them. So I think it's sort of coming out for Newcastle, this game. Because now they're playing Arsenal, big game. On TV, country watching, what you got. You know, and they showed us we can play football for 5 minutes. We didn't quite fancy it. And then we're going to retreat into our turtle shells, right? So so I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking, well, what does this say? What does this say about them? What does this say? I don't think this is who they are. I don't think it's who they're going to be going forward, but it is who they are right now. And I was saying this earlier today, I think the whole league is looking for a story. The media and the narrative is looking for a story. The normal story is Liverpool, Man City, right? That's the story we're used to. Who's going to drop points, etc. And Chelsea doing their pieces, the Man United being FC Hollywood. And this is what we've grown used to over recent years. And Arsenal being the banter club down in fifth to eighth, right? So, but now we've become the story. And the next big story, Andrew, is Newcastle. Hence my tweet about brand Newcastle, right? So they are the next big story. And what are they going to look like? What are they going to represent? Now, if you look at some of their signings, they've signed a lot of English players, British players. And they've got British coaches. And they're hardworking. They're quite British in their approach. Play big, you know, up and down football, set pieces, etc., etc. And I think I expected something different to this.
Did you, though? You know? I mean, do you not think that that is what Newcastle are probably going to have to aspire to be, in the sense that, with all due respect to our friends in the Northeast, there are more attractive places in England for footballers to be. And I know some of that can be offset with money. You know, we've seen that, and you know, that will be the case because they can basically pay whatever it takes to get whatever player they want as long as that player is willing to go there. But it just strikes me that perhaps a sort of very British team might be the thing that they look to build because that will be the easiest thing to build in the relative short to medium term because those players are gettable for them in a way that it's going to be very difficult to, I don't know, you know, sign Kylian Mbappe, even though they could afford it. You know, I know that it's just a ridiculous notion, but, you know, are they going to be able to pry away the best South American players from Barcelona or Real Madrid? You know, this is something I think that they're going to have to be for a while before they can take it to another level.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. And I think I'm not saying this to denigrate them in any way. I just think it's an interesting concept. And I respect what they're doing. I know a little bit what they're doing in the background and their hiring. We know about Dan Ashworth. We know about Eddie Howe. These are known people to us and how they operate. And I think it's interesting, the first phase of Newcastle, if this is the first phase, or is this who they want to be? Given the controversy around their ownership, per se, air quotes, mm-hmm. job, and what better way to tidy that up by being very British? Do you see what I mean?
It's, yeah, it would certainly deflect some of it.
It would certainly deflect some of it, right? I mean, you know, the Gary Nevilles of this world that control the football voice to the world, as we all know, and is the only voice that really matters. The Nevilles per se, well, they like this. This is a story. This is a new narrative. We have a team that's, you know, quite British in its design, but with big money. They can take this a bit further.
Mm.
And we have Arsenal with their crazy young coach jumping up and down the sideline, you know, and we've seen that before, and their lovely flowing football. We want to get under that sort of thing. Mm. You know what I mean? We want to pull that apart. And so it is a very interesting story that's developing to the one that we are not used to, per se.
Mm.
Liverpool Man City story, the Klopp Guardiola story. It hasn't quite had the edges they wanted, you know, with the manager personalities, etc. So they're going to create something else.
And yeah,
it's interesting to see where we fit in this, mate, to be honest.
That's true. And, you know, as we know, Gary Neville is not averse to taking money from the Middle East. So when that might suits. Temper his yeah. view on certain things that are going on there. I want to sort of flip it around back on to us, though. And tactical variety, variation, the ability to change games from the bench is really important for any team that wants to challenge for a Premier League title. My sense of the Arsenal squad this season, you know, if everyone's fit, and I know that's aspirational, but, you know, it is a stronger squad than it was last season. Nevertheless, when it comes to sort of changing the first 11 or being able to apply certain... I mean, look, some of this might be simply down to the fact that most of our games have gone really well this season. We haven't had to react too much. So it's sort of like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it to an extent. But, you know, the changes to the starting 11, like, you don't want to be changing it like four or five players every week. I get you need some continuity. But do you worry a little bit about the depth of this squad for games like this one against Newcastle, where a different kind of threat in the final 15 minutes could have been the difference? I'm not saying we got to go out and buy a target man, but you know what I'm saying? That this, a different threat, something for tired legs to deal with, something that they haven't been used to for 75 minutes, all of a sudden you cause them different problems. You know, we know he didn't make a substitution. He said after that was because the game was going, you know, what he considered was going well. We were on top. I mean, I think there is a conversation to be had about what we had on the bench. But, you know, it is, as much as everybody gets a bit transfer crazy in January, it is grounded in a kind of reality about what we've got to do for the next 5 months of this season.
Absolutely. So I felt we were wide forward short from the summer, and we didn't add it. We got a bit distracted towards the end of the window, and we went for midfielder, ended up with nothing, right? So we got away with it. We managed to keep people fit until the World Cup came along and struck down our centre forward. Now, do you remember the Fulham game when we went to almost like a 3-5-2 and played two strikers up front, brought Eddie on late, and really loaded them up the top end of the pitch with wide wing backs per se? I think the wing backs were Martinelli and Saka, so that tells you what we were doing, right? So I wish we could have brought Eddie on in this game, if you see what I mean, with Jesus. And then suddenly we're having a different discussion that we didn't quite get it, but it wasn't because of energy. We're just one or two short. It's as simple as that. We've got two injuries in forward areas. Smith Rowe is a memory at the moment. We can't wait to get him back. He's a fond memory. And every minute he doesn't play and we don't win a game, he gets better and better. Right?
Of course,
So I think we have to get him back healthy and sustained on the pitch because he's a massive asset for the club. And Jesus is killing himself to get back by mid to late February. Right? So, but we need to add. This is not rocket science to us. We need to add because the game has changed. we have the opportunity with five substitutes to add energy onto the pitch, and we are unable to add energy, and we are seeing our most energetic sprinters play 3 90-minute minutes on the trot in a quite a small space of time. And despite their manful efforts, we lacked a bit of sharpness when it really, really mattered around the box. And that is just where we are. So we, in some ways, Andrew, this game was perfectly timed.
Mm.
It was early January. It wasn't home to Everton. We didn't drop points to them, or home to Southampton, who are in a bad place right now. We dropped points to the meanest defence in the league, the team that are third in the league. We got 7 from 9, and we learnt something in a month where we can react to it, right? And I think that's really important. The time it happened, as long as we react to it, if this happens, remember the end of last season we lost to, was it Palace, Brighton, Southampton? If we find this problem out then in the money months of the year when we really need to win something, this is not a good time because we can't react. But we can react now, and I really feel we must do it, and I'm pretty confident that we will do.
Me too. I just have some concerns about what we're going to do and how we're going to do it, and, you know, how many of our eggs are in the Mikhailo Mudryk basket right now. Yeah. Clearly, he is the player that we want. Clearly, he is a player who wants Arsenal. And I don't think it's necessarily a particularly complicated situation, you know? The simple fact is Shakhtar want way too much money for him. Chelsea have come along now and done what Chelsea do. That is another thing to deal with. Whether the player wants to go there, that's another question. But it wasn't a bidding war, and now it could kind of be a bidding war. Or it might be a case that there's a stalemate. Chelsea bid way above the odds because they are stupid. you know, let's face it. Shakhtar are happy to take that money, but the player doesn't want to go to Chelsea. And Arsenal are sort of in the background. And then you're wondering, you know, what do we do? I mean, how do you view that situation? How long should Arsenal wait? How far should they push for a player who, you know, with all due respect, is obviously talented, but doesn't have a track record that would lend you to gamble excessively on a fee that could be, you know, somewhere in the region of £80 million?
See, I'm not comfortable with that number, mate, that you just mentioned. And
no, me neither.
When we get into these discussions as podcast people around numbers, we leave ourselves open a little bit because it's all rumour and conjecture, and we're never too sure how any deal is constructed and what rumour to believe, right? But we can only look at what he's done on the pitch, and I think he's played 8 times for his national team, hasn't scored a goal, right? So he's played 30 to 40 games for Shakhtar. He's been on loan a couple of times. I'm just going to put a guess out there that he's had 50 top-flight games, you know, professional games.
Yeah, just thereabouts.
That's 50 to 60 of professional games. And he has got unmissable talent. You can see it, right? You'd be dumb. You can't miss it, right? But you get jobs based on your CV and what you've done, and not just what you potentially could be.
Mm-hmm.
And what you potentially could be could reach that number. Well, let's have a deal that's constructed accordingly then. And if he does reach some of those targets, then you have to pay a set of money. And I'm sure that's what Arsenal are trying to do. There are comparative deals out there, which, you know, the Man United, Chelsea, they've just ruined the market, right? Haven't they, with their stupidities, right?
Yeah, so, the comparison to Antony all the time is just like,
yeah, exactly. But the comparison to Gakpo is probably more of the one that's closer, right?
I would agree, yeah.
And even Rafinha, look at his track record, 25, Brazilian international. You know, he went up 50, 55 mil, you know, and he's done a bit, you know, and he knew the club he wanted to go for. Much like Mudryk, he said where he wants to go, more or less. And so there's one club that has an advantage, and that's reduced the market. And Shakhtar are trying to expand the market.
Mm.
We just have to be cool, mate. Stay to our principles, stay to what our value is, and don't move beyond our value. Because as we've seen in the past, and we've spoken about this before, me and you, we can't dismiss the price. I don't like when people say it's not our money, because that player then walks to that price.
Mm-hmm.
and we judge him on that price.
£72 million, Nicolas Pepe.
We judge him on that price, right? It's simple as that. And if someone costs money, we're going to expect certain behaviours. We're going to expect certain delivery, and that's the truth of it. Let's not pretend otherwise. So I'm hoping it's a reasonable number. And not only do we judge him on that price, but the media judge him on that price, and they lay the pressure on that individual. Sure. Just to see if they can break them.
That's another really good point. Like, you know, if it does end up being a crazy price, it's not just fans, but it will be every time he's talked about. It will be part and parcel of the thing. And you know, I think Mudryk is an exciting player. You know, the pace is unbelievable. That gives us an extra weapon. We're quick enough up top as it is, but I think he's just got that little bit of Walcottian fucking Billy Whiz to him, you know?
Yeah.
If it is that crazy money, though, right? It makes something like the João Félix deal look almost reasonable. Because I know it doesn't quite work like this, but if you've got 80 million to spend on Mudryk, you could do the 20 million on the João Félix loan and still have 60 million, and you can do a lot with 60 million.
Yeah.
There are players on the market out there. There are players available right now that you could get with 80 million pounds at your disposal. Maybe not quite the profile of him, but certainly still good players. I'm thinking of Barcelona right now, right? I'm thinking of Ferran Torres, a player who we bid for last summer, a player who Barcelona maybe don't want to sell. He hasn't played a huge amount this summer, but Barcelona are absolutely fucked financially. Yeah. And I remember, probably is it 10 years ago now at this point, there was a Spanish club that were absolutely fucked financially, and they sold us a little genius for around 13 million, 14 million pounds called Santi Cazorla. We took advantage of Malaga, who were in dire straits. Barcelona, bigger institution, bigger club. I'm just thinking about, do you have a time frame on this? Because there's a lot of people talking about, look, we need something before the Spurs game. It would be great to have a signing in before the Spurs game. If you had Smith Rowe and a signing before the Spurs game, I think we'd all feel more confident and happier going to White Hart Lane. So is there a point where Arsenal have to say, look, Shakhtar are being intransigent here? We can't deal with this. We can't deal with their demands. Chelsea are ruining the deal because they're sniffing around like a fucking thirsty dog, even though they've got no chance. You know, it's a spoke in the wheel, if you like. So, you know, at some point, with other important games coming in January, Manchester United as well, let's not forget. Like, do Arsenal need to have a time frame? I think we can assume that they probably have other irons in the fire at this point, that like all the eggs are not going to be in the one basket, because we've seen that this is a club that's been better run than it has been. But should there be a time frame on this?
I would have said that if we had a congested January, but we don't really. We got three games to go in January, is that right? And one is Oxford. Right, so we're not too congested. So I've relaxed on that, but it would, you know, from a coaching point of view, you want to get the players in really, really quickly, right? So my view is, and you mentioned three players there, and I like them all, and I've YouTubed them all to my followers on many, many occasions, and the Ferran Torres one is a hunch I had basically when they got Rafinha, and then I found out about the bid. And I've always quite liked him. He's not as exciting, you know, on YouTube as Mudryk is, but he's a nice player. He's a nice player. I suppose I think what it is, Andrew, where I am with it is, I think we're going to get one. I think we're going to end up getting Mudryk. It's just a price that concerns me. But I think we need two. And the second one is almost more instructive about where we are. And how serious we are. And what, you may say, well, we've got enough. We've got Smith Rowe coming back. We've got Jesus coming back. But they're both coming back from injury. And just because they're coming back on one day doesn't mean on day one they're going to be ready to play to levels that we remember them at. So you take time to come back.
You think we need another attacker, another attacking player?
I do. I think another attacking player, and this is where the Felix one is quite interesting because it is something medium term. The numbers need to be right. But if we are, I don't say if we are serious, it sounds a little bit full of entitlement, you know, but I do think there's an opportunity here, isn't there? And I do think the opportunity will be described almost by how Smith Rowe recovers versus do we need a second one. And if we care about our players, which I know we do, Smith Rowe is at a critical period of his career. He's had this injury for quite a while. He's been fighting this since the Huddersfield days, to be honest, where he's not been robustly on the pitch, and now they seem to put him under a knife and they fixed it, and they're going to protect him. You know, so we have these expectations on him, but they need to protect him. Because he can't break down again. It's too much time. Too much time. And he'll lose key development. So it's very important we protect him. And Jesus has had, it looks like he's had an MCL injury. That's pretty common. There's a common rehab on that. But again, we need to make sure that when he comes back, he can come back in a staged way.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So we're all, you know, we're on open top buses on Upper Street. We're already there, right? But I'm afraid we need the players to take us there. We need enough of them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's a decision. The second one will tell us a lot about where Smith Rowe is, where Jesus is, and the potential size opportunity we have at the end of January. Because if we do well, really well, against United and against Spurs, then hold on a minute, mate. You're just staring at it, aren't you? You're staring at your chance.
Well, yeah, you are. But that's why I think there's a sort of anxiety about getting a couple of players in before those games. Like, I think we're capable of beating Tottenham with the squad and the players that we have at this moment in time. I also think we're capable of beating Manchester United with the players and the squad that we have at this moment in time.
Yeah.
It's just whether or not there will be acknowledgement of that if those results don't go our way. Will it be because, A, we didn't play well on the day, which is probably the most rational explanation, or will it be because, B, we didn't bring anybody in the transfer market? And I think there will be an element after what happened last January that will think, you know what, you've got these important games, you knew you needed a bit more depth, you know, even if, let's say, you don't play particularly well in one of those games and you're looking at an academy kid coming off the bench to give you something in attack, if he's even used, you know, there might not be as much forgiveness or understanding in some quarters anyway.
I agree that. I think last year I understood what we did and why we did it. I was fine with it, and I say that, I said it at the time, and I said it even though we didn't hit the top four, I thought it's more important to clean house than to bring the people in that weren't quite the right people, right? So, but this year I feel differently about it, and I think our levels have gone up, and so we need to go up, and we can't, it's not fair to those academy kids who spend 10 years at the club to be judged in 15 minutes on a big game live on TV. That's not how you protect players, right? That's not how it should work. And so we need to make sure we have the right depth there. I do think in February, everything will become more congested. Europa League kicks back in again. If we're in the FA Cup, that's still going to be there. Suddenly we're traveling away in Europe and suddenly we're back to the Sunday game thing. And we're starting to worry. One little calf strain is 3 weeks. To the wrong player, that's a problem. You know, it's a problem. And so we do need to sort of mitigate that risk, you know. And I am, like I say, I'm already booking the open top bus, but I will say, and I said it to you before, I'm sick of that Europa League music, mate. I don't want to hear it every time. That is the only thing that matters, because this group, on a sporting ambition perspective, needs to be in the Champions League. Bukayo Saka cannot play in the Europa League again.
Yeah.
He can't. No. Right? He's just bounced out of the World Cup with probably three open play goals, and that it can't happen. He needs to go. He needs to be in that Champions League. As do many of these players. Saliba needs to be there. Marte needs to be there. They're at an age now. They need to experience this, and we want them to experience it at Arsenal. So, despite where my head is, And despite the window of opportunity that's there, that's the number one thing that we should be buying for, to de-risk that. And you may think, oh, we're going to be top four and fine. Mate, 3 games a week, and that can change. Simple as that. It can change. We saw it last year, didn't we?
Yeah.
It can change very quickly.
I mean, the development of these young players over the last couple of years has been unbelievable in some quarters. You know, Bukayo Saka at 21 to do what he's doing at 21. But he's not anywhere near his peak. He's not anywhere near as good as he can be. But I think your point about where he needs to be playing to help him develop into that player, it's not against FC Carl in the Europa League. He's got to be playing in the Champions League. So, yeah, I know what you mean. But that then brings us back to what we've got to do. January, there's only 2 more games, you're right, after the Oxford game in the FA Cup, and I expect a lot of rotation in that.
Yeah.
But then you've got a North London derby and you've got Manchester United at home. You win those two, everyone's quite happy to give you until the end of the month to bring in the players you want.
Yeah.
I suppose what I would say, not to sort of make any kind of excuses or anything like that, but it's hugely important that whoever they bring in is the right player for this group, for this club, for this team. Stylistically, they've got the right character, they've got the right attitude, they've done their due diligence on them. Just getting anybody isn't what we need to do, because we did that for too long and that sort of held us back. So that's part of how we make progress as well, is making sure that the transfers we do are the right players.
Yeah, I think so. I think the problem is now, this is the flip side to this, right? So a year or so ago, we were saying, well, you know, Aubameyang might have to go, this player's going to have to go. And we all pretty agreed. The timing, we could debate, but we sort of knew the ones that were sticking out. With the group we have right now, most of the key players we all really like and we're all really invested in. So even talking about transfers is like, that may actually reduce the minutes of someone we really, really like.
Oh, I don't mind. If it's another good player, I don't mind. They'll all get their time.
But we have to get comfortable with that, though, don't we? Mm. We have to get comfortable. Not everybody is. And they say things like, Mudrick, do we need Mudrick? We've got Smith Rowe and Martinelli. You know, and they both play on the left. Do we need him? It's a debate, Andrew. You know, it's a debate. To me, it's another good player. And we don't know where Smith Rowe's going to play, etc. Should he play on the right a bit more? We don't know. So this is the next phase for us, really. And it's back to Champions League music time. Champions League music time, you've got to rotate properly with players of equal quality. And you need to be able to do that on every 3 days. And so our perception of what the squad was and how we've been sort of Arsenal brainwashed, that we are pretty good at developing young people and we don't mind broken soldiers and fixing them. When the day comes we buy a ready-made player, bang, to complete one of our academy kids, it's going to be a challenge for us. You know, it's going to be a real challenge for us. You know, if Joao Felix comes in, for example, he's not coming in to carry the oranges, mate. He's coming in to play, isn't he? And so it's going to be a challenge for us and our perception of the squad, right? So interesting times. We all want the top table, but when we're there, we're going to have to adjust how we view the team and how we view the squad.
Yeah, there's a ruthlessness required to how you build a squad if you want that squad to keep going. I think if you take your eye off the ball even a little bit, you end up like Liverpool this season. And, you know, nobody, I think, would have predicted this fall off for Liverpool, even if you could see, you know, the age curve with some of the players and everything else. I just think they've taken their eye off the ball when it comes to recruitment, and they're paying the price for it. So,
yep, you're right. And just a couple of changes internally, maybe, potentially, a bit of staff turmoil. It doesn't take much to knock the ship off course, right?
Yeah.
A couple of one or two decisions where players come in, is taking longer to hit the ground, and suddenly you're putting more pressure on other players who are not ready. Mm. Yeah, and some of the older players are taking longer to come back from injury, and you suddenly you've got a hole in your team.
Mm.
And even Van Dijk's picked up a hamstring, and he's like a machine, right? So
yeah,
it can change very quickly, mate, real quick.
Well, we'll see what they do in the transfer market. The final thing I just wanted to chat about was you talked about earlier, what's the narrative? What's the story that's coming out of this season? And I think the new one is Mikel Arteta on the sideline. and people taking umbrage and exception to the way that he comports himself, right? Yeah. So we know that Richard Keys is just a fucking, you know, we know what he's all about. He's got this bee in his bonnet about Arteta and his technical area, and nobody really should give a shit about this washed-up old dinosaur. He's been going on about this all season, and nobody gives a shit. But it's starting to become a bit more mainstream. I saw a piece, I think, in The Telegraph, maybe? I can't remember what it was. Yeah. But I didn't read it, but I saw it. And I've seen people talking about it. I've seen Arsenal fans talk about it and saying that this is not the way that a manager should behave and there should be more class and all that kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering what they've been watching for the last 3 years. Who have they been seeing on the sideline? You know, have they been like looking at a hologram of a guy who sits down and doesn't say anything? This to me is part of the Arsenal being good. Now there's more focus on Arsenal. Let's like just pick away, pick here, pick there, a little, you know, have a dig here, a dig there. And I don't really get it. Like, obviously, he's a very passionate guy. I think this is just part of the package where he kind of is what he is, and part of the passion that he instills in the players comes from the way that he behaves on the sideline. I do think, to an extent, some of it is the fact that he's still a young guy and a young manager, and he wants to affect things as much as he possibly can, even though it's kind of out of his control. It's a way of maintaining some control by, some people would say, being out of control on the sideline. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that that's the way they're approaching it, right? But this is who he is. This is who he has been. This is part of why we are where we are. And I genuinely don't want him to change it, not least because it's possibly the most selective bit of, in inverted commas, analysis that I can remember, because every manager does it. Every Absolutely. Single manager goes crazy over one thing or another thing. So exactly. Why the focus, do you think?
Yeah, just win the games, right? That's the most important thing. Do you remember when Jurgen Klopp ran on the pitch to jump on his goalkeeper? He was literally by the penalty spot, nearly.
He ran
on the pitch, and it was all seen as good old Jurgen, you know, good guy, he's got the passion, etc.
Yeah.
Arteta's quite passionate. He had a spat with Klopp at Anfield last year, and they tried to use that against him, right? So, and I was talking to one of your friends of mine, Tayo, today. I was just talking to him offline. And basically, he was sort of saying to me, they tried this with Wenger as well. They tried to focus on his offline behaviour with Mourinho, etc. And it's something that they've done, particularly when it's around Arsenal, to chip away at the manager's perceived class when other teams could do what they like.
Right? Yeah.
And I do think it's a very Arsenal-centric thing that seems to happen. But it is also an indicator that we're back, mate. If this is all they can talk about, we're back. And we just need to keep building the squad to make sure we stay back. Because what they're looking at is our ability, with the youngest manager in the league, with the youngest team in the league, to cope with the pressure. That's what they're looking at. That's the story they want to create. Can they cope with the pressure? Because last year, we didn't cope with the pressure and Spurs got into the Champions League by default. Can they cope with the pressure? They have this lead. No team has not won the league with X amount of points after X amount of games. You can see it building, can't you?
You can see
the story building. The manager's under pressure in January, the first game they've had, and suddenly he's going crazy. They're just building it.
Mm.
So if I'm anybody in their club, I'm saying, all right, if that's what you want, we're going to get better and better and better. And the only narrative you're going to write is our future potential and how many things we're going to win. That's the narrative I want to see develop and make sure our mentality is tip-top super strong. I do think Arteta, some of this is contrived. I do think he's positioned himself with referees. I think you want to say something here, didn't
well,
you?
I did want to ask you about it. I mean, do you think, like, again, I'm fine with it. I think he's, you know, if I was a football manager, that's the way I would be.
Yeah.
I know that. But do you think there might be anything counterproductive to it? I mean, he came onto the field after the game against Newcastle and, you know, shaking the hands of the referee. Like, fourth officials and managers,
yeah,
they're at it all game long. Not just Arteta, not just Eddie Howe. You know, we've seen it. They do, you know, we don't see half of, we don't see 1% of what goes on the sideline because the cameras are on the pitch. But is there any possibility that referees might be influenced by the media narrative around this? This is why I think it's important to frame it like that, that it's not necessarily Arteta behaving much differently from the way he has done or from the way that many other managers do. But if it's out there in the media, is that something that referees start paying attention to? You know, do on-field decisions suffer, or are there consequences for on-field decisions because of this?
I think they will be watching him and his ability to do 10,000 steps in that technical area, right? My watch would be pinging like crazy if I was him. And so I think they'll be watching that. But when it comes down to it, when he speaks about referees, he's fairly respectful. He did shake everyone's hand on the sideline and all the officials, as you noted. I think he chose the word scandalous around the penalty decisions very smartly. Pre-North London derby, Andrew, and to making sure that you know that we didn't get two penalties in the last game. And by the way, in the last North London derby, we just brushed Son on the back post and gave a penalty which caused a big, you know, basically decided the game. And so there are things that are said for effect. And I don't think this is a young man losing his stuff. In fact, the nation in January, I think this is him positioning himself as a manager, and this is who I am. This is how I am. This is how much Arsenal are serious about winning. And you better treat us with respect and stop sending stupid referees like Bobby Manley for his first game at the Emirates. We expect big game referees that can handle it. Right? And that's what we need. And that's a problem. You know, that's a general problem for the game. Having enough referees that can handle these big games against the bigger sides. You know, and we had a referee at the week that didn't handle it very well.
No.
Didn't manage the game very well. And Arteta made his point in a really respectful way, vociferously, but respectful. And when it come down to it, there was no controversy in what he said. You know, so at the moment, Richard Keys has shone the light on him, but he can stand still for a few minutes when it really counts. And that will soon go, and that will shine somewhere else soon, very quickly.
That is a very good point about the... I think it was Andy Madley rather than Bobby Madley who was the referee.
You might be right, actually.
Yeah, one of the Madley twats. But I think that's a really good point about the North London Derby coming up. I hadn't considered that. Considering the track record of penalties that are awarded to the other team in those games, there's maybe just a little bit more method to the madness than people might think, eh?
That's how I would do it. It's time for us not to be, you know, there are two games that killed me last year, hurt me badly when it comes to referees, was the Man City game when Gabriel got sent off. Remember that one when we were flying? And the North London derby. I thought that first penalty was so soft. Not, you know, compare it to one we didn't get in the week, right? It's just it's just nothing.
Yeah.
You can't have moments that decide games like that, you know, based on that. It's not right. So it's all contrived in my opinion.
All right. Good stuff. Okay. Well, we'll leave it there for now. As always, pleasure to talk to you, Clive Palmer. Thanks a million.
Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thank you very much indeed to Clive. You can find him on Twitter. He is at ClivePAFC. That's at ClivePAFC. And of course, you'll hear him more regularly on the Arsenal Vision podcast. Right, I'm going to leave it there for this particular episode. There won't be an end bit for this one because we did one on Wednesday. Whatever about getting two Arsecasts in a week, you can't get two end bits. Got to keep some of that good stuff back, you know? You know how it is. For more podcast action, check out Patreon. We've got an episode of The 30 over there. Myself and Phil Costa talking about the week's Premier League action. We do that every week. And we will have a preview podcast for the FA Cup game as well. That's coming probably on Sunday. Myself and Lewis Ambrose will look ahead to our game against Oxford United. So if you want to get involved with that, you can sign up for a fiver a month. It's patreon.com/arseblog. That's patreon.com/arseblog. Arseblog. The Arsecast Extra this week will be on Tuesday, of course. It will be after the FA Cup game, which takes place on Monday night. For now, take it easy. Thank you, as always, for listening, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.